Moncrief on News Talk.
Because even though climate change affects us all, it affects some far more than others. Invariably, those people are poorer and not white. Jeremy Williams is the author of Climate Change is Racist. And Jeremy joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Jeremy.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Now, I suppose it's a wee bit of a provocative title, given that climate change itself wouldn't have an opinion on any of these things. But certainly the effects of it, if we can talk about that first. In places such as the Indian subcontinent and in Africa, tell us a bit about the disproportionate effects it has on people there.
Yes, well, that's right. So you've hit the nail on the head there that obviously climate change can't have racial prejudices. It's not a person. But outcomes from climate change are very different for different parts of the world, and they tend to fall along racial lines. So as you say, people in Africa, people in India and in small island states as well across the Caribbean and the Pacific face much higher risk from climate change, whether that's from storms or from droughts and famines, any kind of extreme weather. And not only are they more vulnerable to the damage of climate change, they have fewer resources to defend themselves in the first place.
Yeah. And are we already starting to see migration that is prompted by climate change?
Absolutely. If you're in a part of the world that's across the equator, it's already hotter. So obviously, global warming means something very different if you live at the edge of the Sahara Desert, for example, compared to living in, I don't know, Scandinavia or even in Britain. Mm. So we are already seeing places where agriculture is becoming increasingly difficult. Or, for example, if your land has been flooded by salt water, you now can't grow anything, you have to abandon your land. And where are you going to go? It's inevitably, climate change will lead to migration and potentially to a migration crisis.
Yeah, and depending on how bad things get, that would be migration on a biblical scale.
Yes, yes, yeah. Absolutely would be.
Nothing we've seen so far would compare to it, I would imagine. Plus, also, this effect is not just in Africa or Asia. It's, you know, it's in the so-called developed world as well. And there are many examples of this in the US.
Hmm. Yes. So there's a whole movement in the US in particular. It's less developed elsewhere, but around environmental justice. And so one of the things that you find is that if you have to live near a pipeline or near a refinery, or it could be near a toxic waste dump or even a landfill site, inevitably those places get put places where there are low land values. And that is very often places that have a disproportionate number of black and brown residents because of the wealth gap that's already there in American society. You've mentioned travelers on the program today as well. Even locally around England, where I live, we see traveler sites that are often on marginal land, that they're placed in places that other people don't want to live. And you end up with that sort of environmental justice question coming up of whose lives and lifestyles are most valued and who is considered not expendable necessarily, but they're not prioritized.
I was very interested to read that in terms of in the US air quality, that the people responsible for most of the pollution of the air enjoy better air.
Yes. Yes, it's crazy, isn't it? And that's something that we see locally in Britain as well. So I touch on this briefly in the book in passing because it's mainly about climate change rather than air pollution. But in London, which is not far from where I am, black residents of London breathe unhealthy air and yet are more likely to use public transport rather than have cars.
Yeah.
And that's a very real issue, is that if you're on a lower income, you're less likely to have those high carbon, high pollution lifestyle habits. And yet the people who are most responsible, you know, driving their 4x4s or running your wood burning stove or whatever it is that's contributing to air pollution, you're safe inside your car, inside your house, and you're less exposed to those things. So there's a real injustice there.
Yeah. And I suppose another example, and a pretty obvious one is for people, would be Katrina in New Orleans, who that affected the most.
Yes. And that's a sort of iconic example for Americans in particular, where some residents were protected and some were sort of left to fend for themselves. And then when it came to rebuilding Katrina after the storm, you had the most wealthy parts of the city were rebuilt first. And there are large parts of the city that were where mainly Black and Latino residents, was just never rebuilt. And so the whole demographic of New Orleans changed after Katrina, and mostly Black residents were never able to return to the communities they'd grown up in and that they called home. They were just not seen as a priority.
Yeah, it's astonishing, really. Now, this is all. Now, I mean, one could say everything we've talked about so far, economic inequality, racial inequality, is baked into pretty much every aspect of our lives. So, what we've been talking about probably isn't much of a surprise, I suppose, in terms of how to tackle climate change. Now, there are, you know, Paris agreements, etc., etc. Is it your argument that the racial inequality is structurally encoded into that as well? I mean, today Joe Biden and Boris Johnson might mention climate change to each other, two of the whitest men you've ever seen in your life.
Well, it's a good point, because if we were to stop and think about the kinds of discussions that might have been had around climate change 15 or 20 years ago, even, when we really had the time to actually prevent climate change rather than just deal with it as it happens, I think there were probably conversations where people went, well, which parts of the world are most vulnerable? Oh, look, it's small island states, it's African countries, it's places that don't contribute a huge amount to the global economy. Perhaps they're not so much of a priority as we might think. I don't think those were necessarily racist conversations. I think they were probably more to do with economics. Like you say, that's kind of baked into the system, where people look at the value of those economies and, you know, maybe we can afford to delay. I think that's the question that comes up then. We can afford to delay. It's not an emergency. We'll come back to climate change later. And that's one of the ways that I think the inequality and the racism of climate change has already shaped the way that we've responded to climate change. And that's why we need to be aware of it now, that it's not just an environmental issue, it's a human issue, and it's a justice question. And when we become aware of those things, we begin to think, actually, we need to respond in an appropriate way for those places most at risk, and not just what's convenient for us.
Because if the US, for instance, was in imminent peril of losing half its landmass to rising sea levels, it would be an emergency.
Yes, absolutely. And this is something that I hear from friends sometimes. You think, you know, why do you talk about a climate emergency? It's clearly not an emergency. And to which I go, no, of course it's not. For me, I live in Luton. It's inland. it's a relatively poor area of the country in some ways, but we're well equipped to deal with climate change. It's completely different if you live on the coast on a small island where you're seeing salt water creeping closer and closer to your home and to your village. It is an emergency. It's a matter of life and death. And so I think by finding new ways to talk about climate change and about climate justice, we can really bring that sense of urgency back into the conversation. And it's so easy to hold it at arm's length when you're far away from it and you don't see it live and every day. It doesn't threaten you and your family and, you know, your children and their future. And we have to become more alert to the stories of climate breakdown as they're already happening and bring those people to the front of our thinking.
And, you know, that's all fine and well. And to be a bit defeatist about it, your Joe Bidens and your Boris Johnsons, no matter what their personal philosophy might be, they're besieged with various vested interests continually pressuring them to water things down. They're besieged with, you know, their fellow politicians telling them, oh no, the economy will suffer, you know, you lose votes, etc., etc. So it's, pardon the pun, bound to move at a glacial pace.
Yes, well, that has been a problem, although one thing that I find really encouraging at the moment is to look at Joe Biden's climate policies, because not only are they very different from, obviously, Donald Trump's, they're also very different from Barack Obama's. And there's a much greater awareness of climate justice. I mean, he actually uses the phrase climate justice and environmental justice, which America has gone out of its way to avoid in the past. And there, I think we see the influence of a new generation of activists, including the Sunrise Movement, if you come across them, of the youth strikers, who've been, you know, taking action following Greta Thunberg, those sorts of groups that have brought together social and environmental justice. And that is beginning to be seen in American policies, not in Boris Johnson's policies so far. I think he's much more interested in climate policies that will save money or that will make money, and more interested in green growth than in justice. But perhaps Biden you know, being as powerful as he is, will begin to shape those conversations, and we might see more awareness of climate justice in future.
You've been writing about this area and been an activist in this area for quite some time, Jeremy. And as you already said, we're not into avoiding it; we're into mitigating it.
Mm.
How bad do you think it's going to get?
It's a very difficult question, isn't it? Because in some ways, you want to be realistic. You want to know what the worst case scenario is. At the same time, you don't want people to think, well, if it's that bad and it's so bad already, then nothing can be done. Mm. And you skip straight from denying the problem to denying that anything can be done about it. And you get that defeatism. So I think it's one of those things where every point that we can interrupt makes a difference. So we might be headed towards 3.8 degrees. If we can stop at 3.7, that's better. If we can stop at 3.6, that's better again.
Yes.
You know, we might not be able to hold it to within 1.5 degrees. That looks very difficult. But every little degree of difference in between is going to mean lives saved and people able to stay on their land and stay in their homes in those vulnerable countries. So I don't know how bad it will get, but I prefer not to draw hard lines or make too many predictions, but just to say everything we can do will make a massive difference and genuinely will save lives.
Mm.
And let's focus on that.
Before I let you go, Jeremy, can I just read you out some text from some of the listeners? Jim says, I really don't understand why it's necessary to frame it this way. Two things can be bad, but also different. They're not the same thing just because they're bad, says Jim. And Jim, which obviously he's referring to tying together racism and climate change. Kira says something similar. I feel that being divisive is completely counterproductive when it comes to climate change. We need to fix this together and act as one. Bringing the issue of racism in it is only going to make people disengage when we need everyone pulling together. Someone else says you can simplify this more by saying capitalism impacts poor people. Skin colour is irrelevant.
Those are all interesting points and things that I considered a lot when I was writing the book. I think the reason that we do have to talk about it is because, as I said, we've already seen how that racial dynamic may have affected outcomes of climate change already and decisions that have been made. And it will continue to shape our responses to climate change until we can face that. I think the other really important point to make is that, as we said at the beginning, it's not about prejudice. So no one's saying you are racist because you are white and you've caused climate change. It's about structural inequality. And those structural inequalities, whether we like it or not, they do divide along racial lines. And so we have to acknowledge that. The response then is not for us to say, am I supposed to feel guilty as a white person? It's not about blame, but it's about different outcomes and about taking responsibility for those and being aware of them. So I think if we understand racism as structural rather than as personal, it doesn't have to be divisive.
Mm.
And that's the key thing, really.
Jeremy, thanks very much for speaking with us today. Jeremy Williams is the author of Climate Change is Racist. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break, back in a couple of minutes.
Moncrief on News Talk.